It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. The spruce beetle has changed the forests of South Central Alaska, and it's not done. In the 1990s, the beetles killed millions of acres of trees south of Anchorage, transforming thick forests and big trees into open park-like spaces. Those changes came about because of the warming climate. But warming didn't stop, and in the last 2 years, the blight started again, north of Anchorage, and now affects wide swaths of the Susitna Valley. On today's show, we'll learn about the spruce beetle, its life, impact, how to fight it, and what it means for our forests. And we'll also go deeper to find out how the changing climate affects our forests in general, and what the future may hold as temperatures warm and as cool seasons become shorter and less intense. These are the places we recreate, and today we're talking about the science of how they change. Stay with us. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and we're talking today about trees. There's so many trees that have died in our region from the spruce bark beetle. It happened back in the 1990s, and it's happening again, definitely, in the Susitna Valley area. A lot of trees that have died over a pretty large area. And that affects everyone, of course, who's using these public lands for recreation, and it affects private landowners too. And to learn more about it, I asked Elizabeth Graham with the U.S. Forest Service to come on the air with us. Elizabeth's based in Juneau. She's a forest entomologist. And this is a bug problem, and it's sort of a big, broad-scale one. Thanks for being with us, Elizabeth.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I would just like to start by talking a little bit about the scale of the issue with spruce bark beetles. We had this enormous die-off of millions of acres, and then kind of went away, and now it sort of has come back. How big was the previous die-off that had such a big impact on the Kenai Peninsula?
Well, before we go into that, if I can actually correct you on one thing.
Okay.
The proper common name is actually spruce beetle.
Oh.
So spruce bark beetles refer to a group of beetles that can feed in the bark of spruce. But the one that's causing all of the damage is actually called the spruce beetle. That's the proper common name for it. And it bores through the bark and feeds in the cambium and phloem layer in between the bark and the wood of the tree. So
it's not really in the bark, but yeah, okay.
It's commonly referred to as spruce bark beetles, but as an entomologist, we like to try to use the proper names because there's a lot of insects out there, and we can be referring to something entirely differently.
All right, I stand corrected. And probably most of the people in Anchorage, because we all call it spruce bark beetle, but I'll call it spruce beetle from now on.
It's an uphill battle for me, and one little bit at a time, I'm trying to correct that.
All right. So we're going to call it the spruce beetle then. So what is the sort of the extent of the spruce beetle problem that happened before? It was millions of acres, right? I mean, it was one of the largest outbreaks of that kind that we've seen.
Yes, in Alaska, that was the largest outbreak we've experienced to date. And prior to the big mountain pine beetle outbreak in the Rockies, it was the largest bark beetle outbreak in the U.S.
And it went on for several years, and then it just sort of stopped.
Yeah, so, what is important to remember with spruce beetle is that this is a native pest to Alaska. It's not something that was introduced and suddenly started causing damage. It plays a role in our forest, and when conditions are right, the populations can build up to outbreak levels. And when that happens, we can have a mass disturbance event, which is what we experienced back in the 80s and 90s and now are experiencing again.
So I was told at the time that the beetles had kind of run through all the trees that were available, and that's why it stopped. Is that essentially true, that in the previous outbreak, sort of they'd eaten up what was there, and so they had to, you know, the problem sort of subsided?
In some ways, that is true, but they didn't actually go away.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the big trees that supported lots of beetles and produced, you know, they supported a lot of beetles, so therefore those beetles reproduced more, and when that material was used up, the populations start to decline. And there's some other factors that can contribute to the, you know, population decline, but essentially, if there's not a lot of host material or suitable host material available, the population can drop pretty quickly. And then they're still there, though. You know, in an endemic population, one that's not in outbreak mode, their job is to kind of, you know, take out the dead and dying trees and the stressed trees and help thin the forest a little bit. But when, you know, like I said, when the conditions get right, that's where those populations can build up. And then when they have no food source, it can decrease quite a bit. But again, there's climate factors, there's natural controls like predators and things like that can help to reduce it. But in some ways it seems like they disappeared, but really they're still there, just not as damaging.
Yeah. So now we have another, I don't know if the right word would be outbreak, but another sort of very noticeable run of increase in population of the beetles. Where is that taking place?
Yeah, I would definitely call it an outbreak. And I was up there in June, and it's really quite stunning to see the number of trees that have been affected and how quickly it's expanded. So the heart of it is in, you know, the Matsu Valley, and it probably goes north up into like the northern edge of Denali State Park, and then over to Palmer, and down into the northwestern portion of the Kenai Peninsula. And we're still actually conducting our aerial detection surveys at this time, and so we don't have the full extent of the outbreak mapped yet this year, but it's looking to be over 500,000 acres that have been affected by this current outbreak. So it's pretty significant portion or area there.
Yeah. So when you say 500,000 acres, is that like one blob? Is that an area of 500,000 acres in which there's some effect in patchy areas? Or is that like, what does that number mean?
In one blob. The majority of that damage, like I said, is in the Matsu Valley and around that area. But there is, you know, we do find spruce beetle damage all throughout the state. It's the majority of that area is in South Central, but we do have pockets in Southeast Alaska where we see spruce beetle activity, as well as up in, you know, parts of the interior. So that, but yeah, the majority of it is, you know, just where you have a stand of mature spruce, and that's, you know, where we see a lot of damage there.
Mm-hmm. Now, I recall from the 90s, recall very well, that there would be vast areas where every single tree would be dead. And it's actually, you know, taken this long, it's taken 20 years for those trees to die and fall, and they're still lie rotten on the ground and really change the landscape. Are you seeing the same thing in the Matsu area, where sort of every single large spruce tree has died in areas, or is it patchier, or how does it manifest itself?
Yeah, there's definitely some areas where, you know, we're seeing every single tree attacked and killed, and about down to between 5 to 7 inches. I want to say maybe 7 inches is probably the smallest, but there might be some areas where they can go even smaller. So, yeah, and that's where it's, you know, pretty impressive to look at. You know, these beetles are not much bigger, or actually they're smaller than a tic-tac. And but the impact they have on the forest, and as you said, changing the stand dynamics, is sort of what got me interested in entomology in the first place.
Yeah, it's a huge landscape changer, isn't it?
Yeah.
So
yeah, they can drive the composition of a forest.
And also the sort of the use that the forest has for people and for animals, because mobility through the forest becomes so difficult when you have so many fallen trees.
Yeah, for sure. There's a lot of good research that came out from the outbreak in the 90s, not only just the impact on the plant community, but also, you know, sociological studies looking at, you know, how it impacted people in these areas where, you know, they lost big, you know, forests of trees, and how does that impact tourism and or just emotional health, mental
yeah.
health?
Yeah, it had a big impact in, you know, my area where my cabin is in the, you know, northeastern Ketchumak Bay, the Bear Cove area. It was really kind of abandoned. Many, many people just abandoned their places and didn't come back. Now a new generation of people has come in. But yeah, it's a very transformative event. We're talking about spruce beetles on Outdoor Explorer. Not a particularly happy topic, but one that is very important and that I know a lot of listeners are going to want to know about, because so many trees are dying in them, especially in the Susitna Valley, the Mat-Su area north of Anchorage. And with me is Elizabeth Graham, who's a forest entomologist with the U.S. Forest Service. She's joining us from Juneau. Let's get into a little bit of the process of how the beetles' life cycle works, how they get into the trees, and how they do all this damage. Where are they born? Where do they, you know, where, how does the process begin?
I guess where are they born? Well, they're born under the bark. So what typically happens is adult beetles will emerge in the late spring, early summer. So our beetle flight here, they need about a 60 degree day, sorry. And then they will, you know, start their flying, and they'll look for a suitable host. And so a suitable host is typically a tree that's under stress, and isn't producing a lot of resin or any of those defensive compounds that prevent the beetles from boring into the tree. So when a host is found, they'll actually produce pheromones, which are a chemical that's released by the beetles, and that calls in a suitable mate as well as additional beetles that can help mass attack a tree and thereby overcoming any of those tree's defenses. And so those pheromones can be used by us as a monitoring tool and also as potentially as a way to protect trees, although that hasn't been tested yet in Alaska, because once the tree gets colonized and there's, you know, they don't want to be competing with other spruce beetles inside the tree. So what will happen is they'll actually release a second pheromone that's called an anti-aggregation pheromone. And that kind of sends the message, you know, no more room at the end, don't come here. And so in other parts of the country, they've actually used those anti-aggregation pheromones and hang little, you know, pouches on the trees, and those can protect high-value spruce trees from attack. So we're actually testing that here in Alaska, but previous efforts haven't been successful. So we'll see how that goes next year.
So they burrow burrow into that phloem layer, and that's a really important layer of the tree, right?
Right, that's where the tree is transporting all its nutrients and water, and that's a very crucial part for the tree. And what happens is the beetles will create a little chamber in there and then lay their eggs inside of it. And so if you peel back a spruce that's been attacked by the spruce beetle, you can look at underneath the bark. Usually it'll just peel right off if it's already dead. And you can actually see these galleries, and the area where the adult beetles first bored in, and then there's little notches, and they lay the eggs right along those notches. And then the larvae hatch and, you know, kind of radiate out from that initial chamber. And so as they spread out that way, they're feeding in that phloem and basically cutting off the tree's ability to pull the nutrients up to its crown.
So it's that layer that is providing them their food, and then that's the layer that the tree also needs as a sort of as a conduit or as a sort of vascular system to get nutrients through the tree, and therefore obviously with that without that the tree dies. Is it advantageous for the beetle to kill the tree, or is that just a side effect of this process?
In this type of beetle, it's a side effect. There are some cases where the spruce beetles might emerge and then attack the same tree again because it hasn't been fully colonized, and so you could have several generations that could come out of one host tree. But the Latin name for spruce beetle, it's in the genus Dendroctonus, and that actually means tree killer. So this genus of beetle of bark beetles are known for being aggressive and killing trees that can be apparently healthy.
Hmm. So you stated that some trees have defenses in terms of the resins that are flowing through the tree, and I guess are pushing the beetles out when they try to get in. Or how do those defenses work?
Well, I think most of us are familiar with hammering putting your hand on a spruce that has a broken branch and feeling that sticky resin and or getting that sap on you. And if you imagine being a beetle and quite a bit smaller than us, if they can't maneuver through that, and so that acts almost like a sticky card, and they can get stuck in that resin and they can't bore all the way into the tree and successfully colonize it or lay their eggs inside of there.
So certain trees have more resin. Why do they have more resin and others have less?
Well, one of the reasons we don't have as much spruce beetle activity here in Southeast Alaska is because it's a coastal rainforest. And so the tree is able to produce more of that resin when it's a wetter environment. And so when it's drier, they're not able to produce extra compounds like that to protect itself. So that's one of the reasons why, even though we have spruce beetle all throughout the spruce forest here, we only see it attacking trees that are either already dead or dying or on a very stressed site and those kind of conditions.
Smaller trees also seem to be immune, right? Is that because they have more resin, or is it for some other reason?
I'm not entirely certain on why they won't attack smaller ones. A lot of times it's not enough area. The tree just isn't quite attractive enough to the adults. And I'm not quite positive about the spruce beetle, what limits the size range. Like I said, they can get down into some smaller stuff, but it may be that it's just not producing the right compounds to be ideal.
Mm-hmm.
But now, I'm not totally certain on that off the top of my head. Sorry.
Right. No problem. So, I mean, obviously warm weather, dry weather encourage these beetles. We can't control those things. What can a property owner do, if anything, to protect trees?
That's a great question. And I say the first thing that homeowners should be doing is looking at their trees and looking to see if there are any signs of spruce beetle. And, the first thing to look for is going to be any kind of boring dust that's coming out of the tree. And with spruce beetles, it's usually a red, looks like sawdust, essentially, that is coming out, and you usually see it around the base of the tree first. And so just being aware and keeping an eye on your trees is definitely the first step. The next thing is, if you are in an area where spruce beetle is in outbreak mode and you have a spruce that you really value, there are some things you could do that are preventative. One is being really mindful to not do any pruning or anything like that, leaving any kind of downed spruce material when the beetles are flying. Because the beetles are cueing in on the smells of a stressed host spruce tree. And so you don't want to be providing additional attractants and bring them in, and then they find your tree and attack it. So that's one of the main things. Don't do any pruning or thinning or anything like that, between May and July, which is when the peak spruce beetle flight is. Another preventative thing you could do is keep your tree well watered. If it's going to be another dry summer, you may want to just run the hose underneath it every so often and make sure it's not drought stressed. If you want to go even further than that, there are some pesticides that can be used to protect an individual tree. It's not something that can work on a forest level, but for that, I would recommend talking to Cooperative Extension Service or a certified pesticide applicator and investigating whether that would be an option for you. But the most important thing is to look at your trees first, and if it's already under attack, then there's no point in trying to treat it with the pesticides because it's probably too late, unfortunately.
Wow. As I recall from the outbreak in the 80s and 90s, it's kind of a level of intensity that determines whether these strategies are successful. So if you're in a super heavy outbreak, as I recall, there's really very little you can do, and that you're probably going to lose to your larger spruce trees. Would you agree with that?
Well, unless you want to take some efforts, like I said, if you want to use pesticides to try to protect individual trees, there has been some success using different applications as long as they're done properly. We've also started a study this summer using injectable pesticides. So these are ones that you inject directly into the trunk of the tree, and then the tree takes them up. The problem with that system, well, one, we're still testing it. I think it should be successful, but you need to be doing that in advance of the trees being attacked. And so ideally you would want to be thinking about those kind of strategies in the wintertime, before beetle flight and all that stuff. What are your options? And if you can afford to have somebody come out and treat your trees, or would you rather, or if you're able to give up those trees, they may end up getting attacked if you're not able to prevent it.
Yeah. And so we're thinking about getting ready for 2019. It's Outdoor Explorer. We're talking about spruce beetles, the pests that have been attacking the spruce trees, primarily the white spruce and Lutt spruce in south central Alaska. And Elizabeth Graham is with me. She's a forest entomologist with the U.S. Forest Service. My name is Charles Woolforth. Elizabeth, while I have an entomologist on the phone, I would like to ask about what other major pests are of concern in our forests here in this region of Alaska, and also if there's anything going on particularly in southeast Alaska. I'd be interested in hearing about that, too. There was some concern about spruce aphids a year or two ago, and they affected some spruce trees around Kachemak Bay. I'm not sure if that really took off or if it just was a very isolated thing. And I'm curious about any other things that you've been on the lookout for.
Yeah, so starting with the spruce aphid, you're right. We had a big outbreak of spruce aphids a couple years ago, and the defoliation there was pretty impressive. The spruce aphid reproduces asexually, which means it doesn't need a partner, it doesn't need to mate, and the aphids that we have here are all female, as far as we know. So when conditions are right, they are able to, their populations are able to blow up really, really quickly. Only takes a few weeks for them to reach maturity, and you imagine all of them are able to reach maturity. They're all reproducing as well. So there was probably aphids in that area for number of years, but the population levels were kept low because the winters were too cold to be suitable for their feeding. And so one of the things that's interesting about spruce aphid is they actually will start feeding in the wintertime. You can find them actively feeding in January, February, as long as the temperatures are below freezing, and they're sap suckers, so they're drinking fluids from the tree, basically. And so if it's really cold out, they're not able to do that. And so here in Southeast Alaska, we've been dealing with spruce aphids since really the 60s was when the first major outbreaks occurred. And we would really have them controlled by the winter temperatures. So if we had a really cold winter, especially, you know, hard freezes and, you know, single-digit temperatures in March or so when aphid populations would start to get on the rise, it would kill those aphids outright, and then we would see very little activity in the years following. And that's pretty much what happened up in the Kachemak Bay area. As far as I know, I haven't been down there this year to sample, but we've seen a huge reduction in the number of aphids. So we had a couple really warm winters where conditions were just perfect. Populations got really, really big. It was really showy. But usually they don't kill the trees because they're only feeding on the older needles.
That's what I noticed with some of my trees is that the infestation was gone, they added new, I mean, pretty much they lost all of their needles, but then as they added new, what do they call this things that come out at the end? My mind has just come blank. New buds. Those buds, you know, sort of make the tree look green again fairly quickly, even though the needles in the inside of the tree won't come back.
Yeah, they'll look kind of sad for a few years, and that's what we've seen down here as well. But as long, you know, the tree does most of its photosynthesizing in that new foliage.
Mm-hmm.
And so as long as it's able to maintain that, then it's able to, you know, it's not going to put on a lot of girth or anything. It's not going to get much bigger, but it's still alive and it'll hang on. So, we need to keep rooting for, you know, cold winter temperatures and especially early spring winter or cold temperatures to keep those populations down.
Any other pests or issues that are going on in our region of Alaska?
Yeah, there's actually a really showy hemlock softlay outbreak happening in Southeast right now. The majority of it is south of Frederick Sound. However, there is some areas on Admiralty Island near Angoon. And basically, this is another native pest where we hadn't seen it in quite a few years. Historically has been responsible for huge amounts of damage in Southeast Alaska. They feed on western hemlock is what's preferred. And similar to the spruce aphid, they only feed on the older needles. And so they're also called wasteful feeders because they'll only eat like half the needle. And then those needles turn yellow. And that's what we're seeing right now is all these hemlock trees along the hillsides just have this yellow faded appearance, and soon they're going to lose all of those needles and just have the new growth. And we went and investigated this outbreak. A woman had brought in, said, oh, I think there's something wrong with my trees, and she brought in a whole bunch of stuff. And I thought, well, it's probably, you know, we've had a pretty dry summer, and it could just be drought stress. And then she showed us a bag that was just full of frass, which is a polite way of saying insect poop. And when I saw that bag, I knew immediately that this was from hemlock sawfly, that it was a defoliator. And she said, this was just raining down on our deck. And so it was pretty impressive to see it from the air. And usually it would be focused on southern or western facing slopes where they're going to get more exposure. They're a little bit warmer and drier. And just so really impressive. Not as scary as the spruce beetle because they don't kill the trees outright, but they definitely put on a display. And we've been getting a lot of calls and people curious and wondering about those.
Interesting. I wanted to ask, and this probably is most applicable to spruce beetles, but probably also to these other pests as well. Do we need to avoid cutting firewood, and getting forest materials and moving them from place to place so that, you know, in terms of avoiding spreading pests that could potentially do damage in a larger area because of doing that?
Yeah, so moving firewood is a known vector for transporting wood-boring insects. And normally I would advise people to never move firewood, you know, burn it where you buy it. And that's the mentality that we have down in the lower 48. You know, you don't want to be transporting new pests. It's a little bit more difficult to advise that here living in Alaska, where some people might have to travel quite a distance to go get firewood that they're going to need to heat their homes for the year. So it's hard to put a hard and fast rule as to how far you can go to collect firewood. But you can have some safe firewood practices. You know, one is to keep it covered, and that helps, you know, limit the things that are going to come out. Also, you can, you know, not go out and harvest and collect stuff during beetle flight, and then don't store that next to your spruce trees. That's, you know, I think one mistake that people might take is they'll go cut down trees too early and then leave that firewood stack next to their property. And if it's, you know, if all of that wood has spruce beetles in it, you might be adding to that population.
Got it. So it's
It's always a concern that we have of something new being brought in. I'd be more concerned about firewood coming in from the lower 48 than I would us transporting firewood within the state.
Sounds like it's a better to avoid it and use your local if you can. But if you can't, then follow those tips. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's buy it where you burn it is usually what we try to go by.
Great. Well, thank you so much. I've been speaking with Elizabeth Graham, who's a forest entomologist with the U.S. Forest Service in Juneau. Thanks for being on the show with us, Elizabeth.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Please stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on Alaska Public Media. Find the show anytime as a free podcast in the iTunes Store or connect with us online at alaskapublic.org.
As Outdoor Explorer, I'm Charles Wolforth, and today we're talking about spruce beetles and climate change. These beetles have ripped through forests on the Kenai Peninsula, now moving up into the Susitna Valley, really changing the ecology of the whole area. What are they doing here? Well, there's been pretty well established scientifically that climate change is a factor in the rapid expansion of these endemic pests. In other words, they belong here. They're not invasive, but it's unique for them to kill millions of trees in one outbreak, and that's probably because of a warming climate. And on the line with me now via Skype from Fairbanks, I have perhaps the world's leading expert on Alaska ecology and climate change. Dr. Terry Chapin is professor emeritus, a distinguished professor emeritus at the University of Alaska Institute of Arctic Biology and the Department of Biology and Wildlife, and a member of the National Academy of Sciences, and a member of many important national and international panels studying climate change and its impact on our biology. And we've spoken many times before, but I'm really honored to have you back on the radio with us, Terry. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks very much.
So could you... Ed Berg down in the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge did a lot of the pioneering work on the spruce beetles and their impact in our part of the state. Was that one of the first kind of big biology signals of climate change happening on the landscape in Alaska?
Well, it's probably the one that caught people's attention as much as anything else. Another one that was equally big and perhaps even more so, but more distant, is the melting of sea ice. which has totally changed the marine environment.
Yeah, and there's a biological impact to that as well.
Absolutely. The walruses that are appearing on the north coast instead of hauling out on ice floes shows the impact of the loss of sea ice.
Yeah, yeah. I'm focusing more on the terrestrial environment. There's been a big spread of shrubs and bushes farther north and changing the landscape that way, right?
That's right. The shrubs are moving north and they're moving west into areas that used to be mostly tundra. Now they're becoming much more shrubby.
Mm-hmm. And in the boreal forest around Fairbanks, which I guess is largely black spruce, and then in the uplands is a little bit more white spruce and birch. Has that changed at all? Have you seen any pests or any other impacts from warming that have happened there?
Well, two of the changes that are important are, first, the thawing of permafrost, which is the basement of the boreal forest and what most people don't usually see or think about, and then the spread of wildfire, which is something that happens occasionally on warm years, and those warm years are now happening more frequently, so it's a more present part of the world that we see. Those are probably the two biggest changes in the boreal forest.
Right. So can you give us can you quantify a little bit those changes and how big they are in terms of like how much of Alaska might be affected and I guess some sort of a sense of like how this change progresses over the landscape.
I'm never very good at remembering numbers, so I'm not sure how quantitative I can be about this. But one of the changes that's happened is a gradual shift from a spruce-dominated biome to a biome in which deciduous trees like birch and aspen are much more common. This is largely because of more extensive wildfires. So for the last 6,000 years, we've had a spruce-dominated boreal forest, and now in the last 50 years, it's switching towards becoming much more deciduous-dominated, much more dominated by trees like birch and aspen. And we're probably halfway there towards a shift from a largely spruce-dominated forest to a largely deciduous-dominated forest.
Wow.
So that is a huge change.
And when you say halfway there, does that mean like another 50 years we go the rest of the way, or is that something that you can really kind of predict?
I'm not sure how fast this is going to happen. The more that wildfires spread, the more non-flammable habitat we have between the remaining spruce forests. One of the advantages in terms of wildfire is that the deciduous trees that are coming back after fire are less flammable most of the time than the spruce. So it becomes a somewhat less flammable landscape. But then at the same time, the drier it gets, the less wildfire cares about what kinds of trees are in its path. And in the warmest and driest years, birch and aspen will burn just as well as spruce.
Right. Well, as we think about the way that happens, I mean, the spruce burns much more readily than the birch and aspen. And so the big fire years tend to favor replacement of spruce with the hardwoods and the birch and the aspen. How does the melting of permafrost affect forests?
The main thing it does is change the dryness of the soil, because when you have a continuous layer of permafrost, it's like an ecosystem sitting in a bathtub. It's got the water there, and it's held, and the permafrost holds the water close to the surface. So the peat layer on the surface, the peat and the mosses, remain wet, and so you can't have as much spread of wildfire. You can't have the forest don't burn as readily, and it changes all of the ecology of the forest. It changes the way water moves in the forest. It keeps the water table perched, and that's what determines the kind of ecosystem we have.
Huh. So I do want to ask for about a couple of more kind of vectors of this change, and one obviously is insects. And when we look at South Central Alaska and the spruce beetle, obviously this is an insect that in some sense was was cold limited before and it's not now. Can you address how that works exactly? I mean, why is it that the spruce beetles are spreading so much faster in this warmer regime?
Well, I guess two things that happen. One is that there's less frequently really cold temperatures in winter, so there's nothing to knock back the populations that the way they used to be knocked back by extremely cold winters. And then the other thing is that the trees become more stressed, and therefore they're more prone to beetle attack.
Mm. Are there other insects that have taken off? And I guess that the thing about these insects is you kind of don't know what the thing is going to be that changes the forest, right? So if there's a few degrees warmer, and that causes an insect to blow up, like the spruce beetle that maybe people have never heard about, and it becomes dominant, that can have a big impact. So I guess it's hard to predict, but I'm wondering if there are other insects that either up in your region in interior Alaska or elsewhere in the state have caused big change, or that you think could cause big change.
The one that I've noticed most has been the aspen leaf miner. It eats away the photosynthetic cells on both sides of the leaf, the leaves, the cells that gain the carbon for the tree, that feed the tree. And so when it eliminates these cells, then the tree doesn't gain the carbon and the sugars that it needs to grow. And these have always been present in Alaska, like the spruce beetles, but they've been much more restricted in their outbreaks. The outbreak might happen for a year or possibly two, and then it would go away. But now we have years and years of these sorts of outbreaks.
Yeah. So it would seem, I mean, many of us were raised with this concept of the balance of nature, and now we realize really there is no balance of nature, that ecology is constantly changing. But there were limitations on these bugs like the aspen leaf miner and the spruce beetle in the past, and now that limitation is lifted. How does that get fixed in a way? I mean, does that mean we don't have spruce trees and aspen trees anymore, or is there some other factor that can come in, like some predator or something that would put a limitation back in place?
Those are the types of questions that are really difficult to answer, because you never know what it might be that would come in and put things back in balance, or return it, reduce the populations of these outbreak insects. In the case of the aspen leaf miner, I'm not sure it's really clear what's going on with the population dynamics of that species. It certainly does have predators, predatory wasps and things like that, but those haven't been sufficient in most of the time to reduce the populations of these insects.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm speaking with Dr. Terry Chapin, who is distinguished professor emeritus at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He's an ecologist, a biologist, and a member of the National Academy of Sciences, and an expert on how climate change is affecting the biology and the forests and the tundra of Alaska. When we talk about these changes to the plants, obviously the animals of the north are living on the plants and moving around through them, and using them for shelter and food and all the other parts of their habitat. And I have to think that if there's this kind of massive transformation, loss of the white spruce in our area, loss of all coniferous trees and transformation to deciduous trees in your area, and then loss now of the aspen trees, that must affect the habitat for wildlife. What sort of changes have you seen, or do you anticipate from these changes?
One of the changes I wonder about is what it'll do to the habitat for moose. So moose do really well on the willows and aspen and birch that come back after wildfire. So as wildfires become more extensive, there's more habitat for moose. And so that might be a good thing in terms of moose. And yet the situation for caribou is exactly the opposite. They really depend, especially in winter, on lichens. And those lichens are, when they burn away in a wildfire, which always happens when a fire goes through, then it may be up to 70 years before the lichens recover. And so what's going to happen to winter range for the caribou is a really difficult and worrisome issue. So it's not all good and it's not all bad in terms of the kinds of animals that Alaskans enjoy seeing. Another connection that's even less certain is the connection to salmon. The salmon populations have generally been going down in northern areas of the Pacific, and especially in Alaska. And it's not too clear exactly what that is, but some of it may be warming of the oceans and changes in the food webs there. It may be changes in the water temperature or changes in the terrestrial environment that influences the spawning habitat for salmon. But just this general decline of salmon in recent years, and the fact that that salmon tend to be a northern species that like cold water, could mean that there's some potential sources of concern there as well.
Yeah, so many worries. There's something I've noticed. My cabin is out in Kachemak Bay. We were hit early with the spruce bark beetle. It was an area with very large spruce trees, which were these lot spruce. And those trees fell, and they're still there on the ground. And since the trees fell, there have been no moose. And I think that it's probably because they simply can't navigate their way through all these fallen trees. And people really can't either unless you are out there with a chainsaw building a trail. So, I mean, there are some changes I think that might be unexpected. I don't think people would necessarily predict that the moose would be absent because they would simply not be able to navigate through the forest. But that kind of looks like what's happened. And I suppose that's part of this whole story is, as you go into a new regime of what ecology is like, you really don't know what to expect.
That's right. That's a really interesting observation. And that's a wonderful example of the kind of unexpected things that happen that would be difficult to predict at the beginning. The same kind of thing happens for Alaska Native people that are trying to keep their hunting trails open, that when a wildfire comes through, the trees turn all topsy-turvy and block the trails, and it makes it really difficult for people to get out and around on the land.
Yeah. So I think one of the ways that we've conceptualized it, or at least people have thought about it, have conceptualized it, is when we think of you know, growing zones. You know, when you think as a gardener, are you in zone four or zone five, which has to do with how far north you are primarily, though I guess probably also the amount of precipitation is part of that as well. Is that a good way to think about this, that the kind of the climate zones are simply moving northward, and so everything will kind of move north, and what you found, you know, in one spot, you'll find somewhere else? Or is that really a big oversimplification because of all the other factors that play into this?
I think you've mentioned the two biggest factors that occur to me, and that's the changes in rainfall and the changes in temperature. So you're right that the temperature zones are going to continue to move north, and that'll allow plants that require more warmth to do better, such as many of the plants that grow in our gardens. But at the same time, it often means more frequent droughts in the summertime, and that can make life difficult for plants. So in general, in the most of the boreal forest of Alaska, trees are growing less well than they used to, because the negative effects of drought have a bigger impact than the positive effects of warmer temperatures. But then when you go into northwestern Alaska, where it's closer to the ocean and there's more rainfall, then the warming climate becomes a positive thing, and the trees are growing better than they used to. So it's a mixed bag, and those are just two of the factors. Then the insects come into the mix, and that brings another change. The wildfires and their frequency and intensity brings another thing into the mix. So it's difficult to know what's going to happen in any particular place, but in general, in broad terms, we know what's likely to happen, at least in the near term. The longer term is less certain because we don't know what decisions people will make that are going to influence whether climate continues to warm in the future.
Yeah. Well, I have my hopes in that regard, but the story hasn't been so great so far. I guess we were 20 years ago. We were hoping that we would have made a lot more progress by now. And as I understand it, there's quite a bit of change already built into the system in that when we release carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, it stays there pretty much permanently, but the warming that it causes lags quite a bit, you know, by decades. So there's hope, that we'll be reducing our carbon emissions, but even the carbon we've emitted now will contribute to more warming over the century, as I understand it. And I know you've been involved with the IPCC, the International Panel on Climate Change. What are the sort of that far out projections? Not far out as in weird, but far out into the future. I've sort of read some stuff about, regions of Africa becoming uninhabitable because they get too hot, and that's not going to happen in Alaska. But do you have a vision of Alaska like in 2100, if the sort of the most likely scenario of emissions takes place? And I mean, do we end up like British Columbia? Do we end up like Washington or Oregon, or do you have a picture in your mind of how we end up looking?
My optimistic picture is that people will come to take climate change much more seriously than they have in the past. And if we drastically reduce carbon emissions, if we allow for the recovery of forests so that they become a stronger sink that removes carbon from the atmosphere, I think we can get things back under control on towards the end of the century and have a much more livable environment, or at least things won't continue to warm as rapidly as they have in the recent past. If we continue not to take climate change seriously, then I think it's a different picture. We're already moving to the point where Fairbanks is approaching the environment of central Saskatchewan. So by the end of the century, we might be a prairie province rather than a forested state.
Wow, that's such a weird concept. Yeah.
It could be a radically different world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And exactly how that plays out for any given amount of warming is largely going to depend on precipitation, because as it gets warmer, then there's less ice cover to the west, and so more of a moisture source in the autumn. And so we could get more precipitation, more snow, and greater precipitation in the winter time, but that's could create some counterintuitive changes as well. Because if the snow continues to accumulate, then it's a better thermal buffer. It's a better blanket in the winter time, and the ground can't lose its heat as fast as it does at present. So that could contribute additionally to the warming of permafrost.
Fascinating. Yeah. So it's Outdoor Explorer. I'm speaking with Dr. Terry Chapin, distinguished emeritus professor of the University of Alaska Fairbanks. It strikes me, Terry, that as we talk about this, the South Central region is quite different from the interior region, as I guess you would expect it would be, and quite different also from the Southeast Alaska region, in that when we look at model projections for our area down here in Anchorage, we're looking at less and less snow cover during the winter, until we'd have at sea level, very intermittent snow cover. And that's kind of already happened in Southeast Alaska. But then in Fairbanks, up in the interior and Arctic, which had traditionally been very dry, maybe more snow cover. And I guess it kind of leads me to sort of a final conclusion, is that there's this chaotic aspect of this, which is not only unpredictable, but that if we think about things just sort of changing climate zones, like we're going to be more like, Saskatchewan or whatever, that's kind of assuming a smooth change. But with all these changes going in different directions, there could be quite a period of just disruption, which is not really anything, right? It's just a sort of unproductive or chaotic state for quite a while.
Well, you've hit upon a really important point, and that is that Alaska is incredibly diverse climatically, ecologically, and so forth. And if it's probably equivalent to three or four states anywhere else in the United States where the climate might be more uniform over the smaller area that are occupied by those states. But Southeast Alaska and Interior Alaska and Arctic Alaska and South Central Alaska are really different worlds. And so it's not too surprising that they're changing in different ways. And the observations that you made about the loss of snow cover in South Central Alaska and Southeast Alaska are not too surprising when you think about what happens in a warmer winter, where suddenly more of the months are above freezing, then the snow will melt. But if Alaska, if Interior Alaska continues to have sub-freezing temperatures during most of the winter, then we might get the opposite pattern. So again, just as you're saying, you can't take simplistic projections of the future and assume that those are going to apply everywhere in Alaska.
Mm-hmm. And then these changes affect the biology and thing in ways that we don't necessarily have the capability to predict, simply because we've never seen them before. And maybe that's one of the lessons of the spruce beetle, is that nobody saw it coming, right? And it was huge.
That's right.
So whatever is going to hit us next, we don't know what it is.
Well, the biggest thing I think that could hit us positively or negatively is the decisions that people make about fossil fuel emissions and other ways to reduce the amount of carbon in the atmosphere, because that's a very positive thing that we could do that would reduce the rates of climate warming well before the end of the century. Whereas if we do nothing about that, then climate's likely to continue to warm well past the end of the century.
Right, and that's well within our control. We may pretend it's not, but each of us emits a tremendous amount of carbon, and we each, as Alaskans, have quite a very powerful political voice, much more so than most other people in the world.
That's absolutely true. We're fortunate in having many fewer senators than other states, which means that the senators that we do have listen very carefully to what goes on to what every individual in Alaska has to say. So we all have an opportunity to make our voices known to the people that represent us in Washington.
Yes, absolutely. Well, this has been fascinating. I thank you for your time and your insight. I've been speaking with Dr. Terry Chapin, who is a distinguished emeritus professor of ecology biology at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and author of many, many hundreds of papers, textbooks, and many other things, a member of the National Academy of Sciences. Thank you very much for being with us, Terry.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, that's all for today's show. I want to thank entomologist Elizabeth Graham from the U.S. Forest Service. She joined us from Juneau. And then we heard from Terry Chapin, Professor Emeritus of Ecology at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Our producer on Outdoor Explorer is Eric Bork. Assistant producer is Hannah Duro. My name is Charles Wolford. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and in your favorite podcast app. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.